From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We're just kicking off our re-election campaign. I'll be traveling around the state, going to every one of our 102 counties multiple times over the next year.
You know, Peoria is the center of mining equipment manufacturing really in the world. It's an incredible strategic position that we have, and great business like Philip Hagenbaugh is core of that.
We're kicking off the new election season. You know, we got now. Seems like it's going to be forever, but it's 12 months from now is the election, next November.
Well, I want to roll it back down to 3% over time. You know, there are many states that have no income tax. Now, I haven't argued that we should go that far, although I'm open to that. But there's no reason that we can't bring that income tax hike back down to 3%. Over the next few years. People say, well, we didn't have a budget for 2 years. That caused a problem. That's not the case. What's happened is 35 years of deficits has caused our problems.
Governor Bruce Rauner, he's out on the campaign trail running for re-election. He also has a primary opponent. We're going to talk more about that. Also, Democrats have a pretty interesting race as well in the race for governor. We'll be discussing that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and joining us at our Statehouse Bureau today, we have Charlie Wheeler. Charlie's Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter. And Dave Dahl joins us this week, our guest. He's from WTAX Radio in Springfield. Dave, good to have you on once again.
Thank you.
I'll start with all of you downtown, I guess. Anybody that wants to jump in on this, the governor is now taking to the campaign. He's been out making several stops in Chicago and also many downstate areas. Is there a common theme we're hearing from the governor?
Yeah, the theme is the one, it's returning to a sort of classic hit. It's Mike Madigan is the root of everything that's wrong in Illinois, and you should vote for Governor Rauner because he will continue to try to stick it to House Speaker Michael Madigan on the Democratic side.
I want to point out a little twist from 4 years ago, and I might point out that 4 years ago, Bruce Rauner said that it was going to be an eight-year thing, so there was no suspense here, and he's salted his campaign coffers with millions of dollars. He said in Decatur this week, when you see a candidate for the State House, ask, are you going to vote for term limits, and are you going to vote for Mike Madigan as Speaker? So that's a little different from, we've got to wipe out Madigan. It has gotten into the governor's brain that most of Illinois is not going to see the name Madigan on the ballot, and the way to get rid of him would be to vote in a lawmaker in the State House who would vote for somebody else for Speaker.
Are any of the ones of you who have been covering him, and Dave and Brian, I know you've been out seeing some of these events, is he mentioning the fact he has a primary opponent? Is that coming up at all?
No, it didn't indicate her, and they cut off the questioning before we had a chance to ask about Jeannie Ives.
And Jeannie Ives, a state representative from Wheaton, and considered to be a pretty staunch conservative. She, and Brian, you can talk more about this, some of the reasons that she decided to get into this race. She's upset with Governor Rauner on some decisions he's made. Again, does she pose much of a threat to him?
Well, let's talk first about why she's in the race. A couple of bills that the governor signed that she and other conservative Republicans don't like. One of them had to do with making Illinois a more welcoming place to people who are in the country illegally. The conservatives have decried it as making Illinois a sanctuary state, but the governor and Democratic backers of the legislation lined up a bunch of law enforcement organizations to say, no, that's not the case. This is, in fact, they called it the Trust Act. They say it's about making it so that if you're in an immigrant community and you're a victim of crime, maybe, you know, you're more likely to cooperate with law enforcement because you're not worried that they're just going to turn you over to the federal immigration authorities, even if you come forward as a victim of crime. That's one. Another one, probably even more significant and a more hot button issue to people who believe passionately that abortion is wrong, is he signed a bill that allows for public funding of abortion, either for people in the state's Medicaid program, the program of health care for the poor and disabled and elderly, and also people on the state employee and state university health insurance plans. this is something that he said he would do back during the campaign in 2014. He filled out a questionnaire that, that said he would support this. And of course, his wife is a big supporter of so-called pro-abortion or pro-choice groups. But he also reportedly has told lawmakers that he would veto this legislation. And so he kind of was speaking out of both sides of his mouth. He ultimately decided to sign it. And that seems to really be the thing that pushed a lot of Republicans or some number of Republicans over the edge and inspired State Representative Jeanne Ives to declare her candidacy.
And so does she have much of a shot here? I mean, it's certainly she doesn't have a shot to outspend him. We know that.
No, but she is. I mean, she's raising, tens of thousands of dollars here and there. Virginia McCaskey of the family that owns the Chicago Bears chipped in about $10,000. She has enough money to start traveling the state. There's no way she can match his spending. I think he has 60, I don't want to quote the figure wrong, but I mean, he has tens of millions of dollars in his campaign account and tens of millions more dollars that he can drop in on a moment's notice. But, we'll just have to wait and see how the voters decide. It certainly, one wonders, I think even if she's not successful in winning the primary, she can, he's going to be asked about things she says on the campaign trail, and it's going to provide an opportunity for reporters to try and press him on some issues that he would probably rather not talk about, looking ahead to running for re-election in a state that Hillary Clinton won handily and where President Trump is not very popular.
I've got to wonder how many conservatives there are in Illinois who are going to say, yes, I'm going to pull a Republican ballot, but I'm not going to vote for Rauner, I'm going to vote for Ives. I've got to wonder how that pencils out. I would think a lot of people who dislike Rauner would be voting for a Democrat. We'll point out that 4 years ago, Governor Quinn got only about 70% of the primary against T.O. Hardeman.
That's a good point. And Charlie, when the governor goes out, now he has got a good 3 years under his belt here as governor. Usually when somebody's running for re-election, they tout some of their accomplishments, things they've been able to do. Do you see anything there that the governor can really stand behind that he's been able to accomplish? Certainly this budget impasse overshadows a lot.
I would say the one area where he's had some success, and it's been bipartisan success in that he's worked with legislative Democrats, is in the area of criminal justice reform. They've moved forward on several different issues with the goal of ultimately reducing the prison population by roughly a quarter. But other than that, there's not a whole lot that he can point to. And listening to his talk about 35 years and his talk about Madigan, it occurs to me that when he ran the first time, people voted for him because he was not Pat Quinn, more so than they really liked Bruce Rauner, I think, or at least a lot of people did. And he ran against Quinn, and Quinn's failed governorship. Now he's running against Mike Madigan, hoping that people will vote for Bruce Rauner because he's not Mike Madigan.
His biggest accomplishment is not being Pat Quinn, and I think he's lived up to that. He's also been quick to champion his signing of the school finance bill, and every time he does say that, I think Senator Andy Menar cringes a little bit.
Well, that's another example where it was a bipartisan effort. He tried to derail it, he failed, and he signed it, and he took credit for it. Governors do that. They sign the bill, they take credit for it. By the same token, when the state's finances go to pot during your time, you can't blame it on people who served decades before you.
Well, Dave, let me go back to that. You said that he's, touting the education issue. He has certainly talked before about Chicago schools. He wanted to see more reforms there. Is he bringing that up at all, especially to the downstate audiences?
Didn't hear him mention Chicago. In fact, the bill that he signed is described as a bigger bailout for Chicago than the one that he didn't sign. So it's one of those where we're in the social media world, the soundbite world, 140 characters, which I will still hold to 140 characters, the elevator speech, say it in one or two breaths, and as Pat Quinn, I'm sure, still says, if you say it fast enough and you say it enough times, the better it sounds.
Let's go over to the Democratic side. It's even a more crowded field there, of course. A lot of people think the front runner right now, maybe J.B. Pritzker, he again has the most money to spend in this campaign. He made a little bit of news this week, and Brian, maybe you can fill us in on what he had to say.
Yeah, he's been the state senator Daniel Biss, who's one of his rivals for the Democratic primary nomination, has been really pushing this storyline about when is Pritzker going to release his tax returns. This is something that it's a norm. There's no legal requirement that candidates have to release their tax returns, but it is a norm in American politics, or at least it was, I should say, until then-candidate Donald Trump decided not to release his at all. And turns out you're able to still win election. The voters seem to not really care that much about whether a candidate or, you know, at least when it comes down to that final partisan choice. But State Senator Biss released his returns. It showed that he is a what would the term be? A multi-10,000-aire based on his income. Pritzker is said by Forbes to be worth more than $3 billion, which is, you know, makes Governor Rauner, who himself is a multi-hundred millionaire, you know, look like he's, you know, a penury case. So it's something that people have been interested to see what Pritzker would do. So Biss has been pushing the storyline, and he must have kind of hit a nerve this past week because I've saw Republicans started picking up on this messaging. He released a web video in which he had side by side Pritzker and President Trump from when he was a candidate using very similar language about, well, my taxes are very complicated. Complicated, they use this word. And that seems to have kind of hit a nerve. And so Pritzker announced that he would release his taxes, not yet, but by the end of the filing period, which people took to mean when candidates file for office. Why the delay? One can only wonder what sort of exotic financial instruments and things that people who are that wealthy do to manage their money. I certainly have no idea, but I know that when Governor Rauner released, you know, the summary, he didn't release his full taxes, but the little cover sheets of his tax returns and his through his economic disclosures, there's a lot of exotic sounding funds and things like that. And people have reported on offshore accounts that he has. So presumably, if you are running as the man of the people and the People's Party, as the Democrats fancy themselves, maybe having, you know, Cayman Islands bank accounts goes against that messaging.
Pritzker, I said before, is considered on the Democratic side to be the front runner right now. Dave, would you agree with that? Or is, I mean, the fact that he's, you know, maybe be feeling a little pressure from Daniel Biss, maybe things are tighter than we think they are.
Well, it sure looks like Pritzker is out there spending. He's out there campaigning. I think it's kind of difficult to extrapolate myself from being inside here and following it all the time when the rest of the state is worried about, you know, scraping together enough money for Christmas presents, et cetera, and, you know, other than the constant advertising, barely aware that there's going to be an election and who's going to be in it. You know, with Kennedy, you're waiting, and, you know, it looks like he's just doing some of this small beer stuff and writing on his name. Will that be enough? Senator Biss, I think a lot of people have respect for, but, you know, would it add up for him? I mean, he's sure trying to be a fly under Pritzker's skin, that's for sure. But, you know, Pritzker looks like the front runner for being active and for his super spending. I think it's been reported or speculated heavily that Kennedy really can't self-fund the way Rauner and Pritzker have, and we're in an environment now where that's what you must do.
And Pritzker has locked up a lot of endorsements from both regular party organizations, the county chairman's association, and as well as from labor unions. So he has been out there. He's got a big bus with his name on the side of it. And a lot of that seems to be his money. Not only is he able to advertise and tour the state at will, but he can also promise that he will share his wealth with Democratic candidates up and down the ballot. And I think a lot of, particularly the regular party organizations, hear that. And that's music to their ears, because then they don't have to worry as much about spending time raising money. They can use that time for other pursuits, knocking on doors or golf or whatever it is they'd rather be doing than raising money.
And Charlie, we've talked in the past about the exceptionally wealthy candidates in Illinois, and it's not been a state that's always been
so open to that, even though we have had a few. I mean, Peter Fitzgerald, as we went to the U.S. Senate, of course, Bruce Rauner winning, J.B. Pritzker could very well be the Democratic nominee. But it's not something that's played all that well in Illinois through history, has it?
The times have certainly changed in terms of the money aspect of campaigns. The amount of money that Bruce Rauner spent and Pat Quinn together set all kinds of records. And now there's talk about the governor's race this time around could turn out to be the most costly governor's race in the history of the nation, hundreds of millions of dollars. Back a decade ago, if a candidate spent $20 million, it was like, wow, what a big spender. But times change. And the advantage someone who is super wealthy has, as we saw Bruce Rauner with the Republican Party, you can go in and shore up county organizations, grassroots operations, and in essence, you can buy the operation, which Rauner did. He bought the Republican Party. It was fair and square. It was done with eyes open. People went along with it. And so now he's calling the shots, and that's why he gets so upset when Republican lawmakers don't do what he tells them to do. I don't know if Pritzker winning will have that same impact because you have Mike Madigan as a counterbalance, but it'll be interesting to see. But it's gotten where someone who's basically an ideas guy, like Daniel Biss, is having a hard time getting much traction with all of the money out there that allows Pritzker to seemingly be everywhere all at once.
Yeah, the endorsements, it's interesting to see, you know, what weight they really have. But it is interesting, too, to juxtapose, well, Pritzker has big labor and all the constitutional officers, and Biss has Ann Williams and Will Guzzardi.
You know. And several other lawmakers have endorsed them as well as some local groups, but nothing like the list that Pritzker can trot out.
And because of the media environment we're in, one wonders how many debates they're going to sit for. I personally moderated a candidate forum a week ago. The Pritzker campaign decided to sit it out. Most of the other camps, Mr. Diver, who is a state superintendent, a regional superintendent of schools in Madison County, came himself. Several of the other campaigns sent lieutenant governor candidates, Rod Joy, and for the Kennedy campaign, and Representative Letitia Wallace for the
Daniel Biss campaign.
But the campaign of Tia Hardeman, his running mate, fell ill and was not able to attend. But the Pritzker campaign just decided to skip it altogether, didn't send Pritzker himself or his running mate, Representative Juliana Stratton. So this is something where, because he has the money to reach voters directly on television as well as on social media, which we're seeing, I've heard somebody saying on a discussion recently about, you know, Facebook is not a place where, is not a component of our democracy anymore. It kind of sees itself as the field where democracy is played out. And you think about the role that it had in the election, which we're still just learning about last year. You know, you can be on Facebook advertising and reaching voters in such a targeted way that he doesn't really have to necessarily, or maybe he feels he doesn't have to go to as many debates and candidate forums. He can just reach out to voters directly with his message without us pesky reporters putting our own, you know, thoughts and context on what he has to say.
Let's move along, because the governor did take some action this week on some legislation that grew out of the whole discussion over sexual harassment and complaints that have been filed involving state government. The governor signing a couple of pieces of legislation. Brian, what did those bills do? And the governor also, I guess, had some advice for lawmakers, wants to see more done.
Yeah, the main one that he signed toward the end of the week has to do with a statute of limitations on ethics complaints. So as we've had this kind of explosion of sexual harassment allegations across the country that did not leave out the Illinois capital, there were some allegations here. And through somebody testifying about that, it kind of became widely known that we haven't had a legislative inspector general for going on almost 3 years now. And so the lawmakers quickly rushed to appoint a former federal prosecutor to examine what is reported to be 26 or 27 cases that have built up during that time. But one of the things lawmakers had to do to enable her to do her job is extend a statute of limitations. There's currently a one-year limit between when an investigation can be begun and the date of the last alleged act of wrongdoing. So they had to extend that. The governor signed the bill, but he kind of indicated he was holding his nose doing it. He says that they really need to do other things to strengthen the state ethics legislation dealing with legislators. And he also pointed out that there's an additional time limit in the bill. I don't want to get too into the weeds of it. Democrats and even some Republicans said, look, we know that there are other things we need to do here. We just kind of wanted to get the ball rolling, and this is the basic thing we had to do to let this investigator begin.
I'm kind of at a loss on this one because something had to be done. Something was done. It passed unanimously. The governor said it doesn't go far enough, and then he signed it. So, again, no suspense as far as I'm concerned.
Well, going forward, I believe there's task forces set up to consider other changes that may need to be made. So this issue is not going away probably anytime soon, I'm guessing, because I would think well into the new year we're going to be hearing some of the findings and some of the hearings that will probably be held regarding these task forces, if nothing else.
Yeah, I certainly think that the people who believe that sexual harassment is a problem in Illinois government, as it is in a lot of places, definitely don't want this issue to recede. And so while the ethics complaints themselves, that is a very secretive process, we may never hear. If none of those 26 or 27 cases are ever found to have any substantive basis in them, we will never hear what happens to that. That is a very closed process. But as you mentioned, there are these task forces out there, one in the House, one in the Senate, with dozens of people on them, and they are certainly going to be trying to keep this issue front of mind for Illinois as we move into next year, and I'm sure we have not heard the last of it.
Well, you mentioned that that's a pretty closed process. Is that something that some people are talking about, opening that process more?
I mean, the governor said he would like to see that, but none of the ethics processes in state government are really all that open, and they only do ever come to light, typically, if a case is founded, and then the documents are then released to the public. But it's a closed process, and it was designed that way in part because, you know, anybody can file a complaint about anything, and they didn't want to necessarily tar someone for, you know, someone's reputation if there was no foundation behind it. So that is something that people have talked about making more open. Right now, one of the concerns is just with the fact that the legislative inspector general position has been vacant for so long. People who filed a complaint wouldn't even hear if the complaint had been received. So there has been talk, and specifically Senator Christina Castro, who's the newest member of the Ethics Commission. She was just appointed earlier this month, the Legislative Ethics Commission. She says she wants to improve some of the basic customer service aspects of, like, if you file a complaint, you find out if it's been received, for example. But other than that, I'm not sure that you know, lawmakers don't like the idea of themselves, you know, anybody can just come forward and file a complaint with this inspector general and then have it be public. I think that would be, it would take quite something, quite an uproar to change that.
The way the operation works, is, as I've mentioned before, it's similar to how judges are disciplined, where there's a body that receives the complaints. In this case, there's an inspector general for the judicial branch, there's the Judicial Inquiry Board. And they evaluate the complaint. Is it valid? Is it sound? Is there something there that violates some policy, some law? Is this something that needs to be addressed? And if it is, then it is forwarded to the Ethics Commission, in the case of the legislature or the executive branch, and to the Courts Commission, in the case of the judicial branch, which takes action against the person who's been accused of some wrongdoing. And it's also tantamount, if you will, to a grand jury process, where what goes on in the grand jury is secret. And an investigation is carried on. The prosecution will present the evidence backing up why they think a crime has been committed, and it's up to the grand jury to decide whether or not there are grounds to go forward with a formal charge. Once the indictment comes down, then it all becomes public when the case is actually tried. But it's a way to, I guess, shield potentially innocent people from folks who have a grudge and are trying to make them look bad.
Dave, there's a kind of a saying out there that you can't legislate ethics, and that, you know, you can try to pass as many laws, put as many processes in place, but sometimes people, you know, they're going to act the way they're going to act. Do you think that what's come out here recently and maybe some of the actions lawmakers have taken, does that change the mindset? Does that change the behavior that some of these women have alleged has been going on?
I think once we move on to the next outrage, you'll probably see more of the huggy-kissy stuff that we see, for example, on the House floor at the beginning of every day between the lawmakers. I think there's been a chill right now. But, you know, I want to say that I'm not Ira Silverstein and I'm not Denise Rothheimer. But, you know, you look at those messages that have been published that the two exchange, and they look dumb more than anything else. I mean, we've made scandal boring. So you got to wonder, you know, what weight of a punishment there should be for the senator beyond what his own family would levy upon them. And I also wonder about not necessarily innocent until proven guilty, but there are allegations against someone, and now there are more, and now there are more. And, you know, what's the burden of proof? Again, no disrespect intended, but, you know, it seems like social media nation is really quick to believe some of these stories and want to punish people.
And I think this—I
wonder about that.
And I think this goes to one of the points that State Representative Sarah Feigenholz, who is one of the people who was outspoken on this when it first came up a few weeks ago, made, is that she doesn't want this to be about individual lawmakers and individual acts of wrongdoing. They want it to be about the culture that allows this sort of thing to flourish, and where people don't speak up and say when they witness something like this. And so that's where, to her mind, it wasn't necessary to name individual wrongdoers. They wanted to have the broader discussion about the attitude of men in general.
All right. Time now for our notes from the field. Charlie, let's start with you.
Okay. There's going to be a vote, or at least a scheduled vote, on Monday by the Board of Elections on withdrawing Illinois from a national kind of database comparing voter registration. And the concern about this controversial registration program is that it is not sufficiently protected from hackers so that Illinois identification would be available to somebody who breaks into the database. It's called the Voter Registration Cross-Check Program, and it's run through the Kansas Secretary of State's office. And as I say, the concern is that the data that Illinois would ship to the Central Clearinghouse could be easily hacked, and people could find out identifying information about Illinoisans that could be used for bad things.
Brian Mackey?
Yeah, interesting case at the Illinois Supreme Court this week. Basically, the question is whether the government can seize a woman's Harley-Davidson motorcycle worth $35,000, even though it was her husband who used it to drive drunk.
I will leave it there for this week. Members of our broadcast today included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Dave Dahl. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. The production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.